Good evening, friends. Franz Weinschenk here, welcoming you to another exciting edition of Valley Writers Read. As you probably recall, none of the writers on our show come from back east, or from the south, or from Hollywood. That's because we only feature authors who currently reside or in the past have lived right here in the San Joaquin Valley. And so it is with our author tonight, who hails from Tehachapi. We've had her on the show many times. Her name is Valerie Schulz, and she's going to be reading a couple of her very thoughtful stories all about birth, life, and death. She entitles these stories Some Kind of Bee and Four Seasons and the Moon. Here's Valerie.
Some Kind of Bee. A random insect turned my mother into an old lady. She was driving home from the market on a Tuesday, double coupon day. She had opened both front windows of the car halfway, enjoying the takeover of spring, while graceless old snow that didn't have the sense to melt away littered the gutters. Then, as she put it, a very large bug, a bee of some kind, flew through the passenger window. It took a leisurely buzz around the car, winged close enough for her to see its yellow and black downy stripes, actually brushed her lips, as if to say, "Well, I could sting you," and exited her window. While all this was happening, my mother had her first auto accident. She only clattered up over the curb and got hung up on a tree stump, but to hear her tell it, you'd think her car had gone over a cliff and she'd had to be freed by the jaws of life. "It happened like slow motion," she told us in amazement, "like when your dad used to show the home movies of you three in the motel pool, going down the slide, and you could see the muscles in your faces winding up to hold your breath. Well, like that," she said. "I knew I had lost control of the car and was not even on the road, and all I could think about was Gert Johnson at Daisy Berrigan's funeral luncheon saying, 'Daisy had such a cute figure, you'd never know she was 76, but she had heavy legs.' What an epitaph. She had heavy legs. So I want you to promise to cover my ankles in my casket." My brother and sister and I looked at our father, who shrugged. "Since her accident, this is all she talks about," he said. "I keep thinking it'll pass." My mother, who had been comfortably late middle-aged until then, talked about death, dying, and funerals. "No flowers for me," she told my brother Tom. "At my funeral, have everybody throw bird seed, like they do at weddings now." He called less frequently after that. When my daughter Lily announced her intention to be a vet when she grew up, in another 15 years or so, my mother answered, "Well, I'm sorry I won't be around to see the first doctor in the family." "Where's Grandma going?" Lily asked me. "Why don't you read Grandma one of your nutty nature riddles?" I said. On the ride over to my parents' house, I had heard at least a quarter of the 101 jokes the cover of her book promised. "Grandma needs a good laugh." "What do you get," Lily read, "when you cross poison ivy with a four-leaf clover?" My mother looked at her. "I give up. What?" said my father, right on cue, giving the only appropriate response to a 7-year-old child with a riddle book. My father was known for his way with children, one of his ways being that he was a pratfall expert. He could win over the shyest child by pretending to walk into the wall or by opening a cabinet into his nose with a loud make-believe yelp. My father was a child's delight. He endured the aunts and uncles' gossip, held his own in the masculine workplace, but he was most himself around children. Kids could sense this. Lily certainly could. "When you cross poison ivy with a four-leaf clover, you get a rash of good luck," said Lily. My father laughed, almost in surprise. "Hey," he told Lily, "that really is funny." "I don't get it," Lily said. "Yes, Fred, explain it to her," said my mother. "The rash," said my father. "You know how poison ivy gives you a rash, itchy bumps. Well, then a rash of good luck. Good luck comes from a four-leaf clover, right? And a rash also means, say, a sudden streak," my mother interrupted, seeing Lily's confused face. "A rash of good luck, honey," she said, "is what we all hope for before we get old." There it was. My sister Nell had told me that my mother ended every sentence now with, "when you get old," followed by four dots. Nell said you could hear the dots when she exhaled. "My washer isn't spinning right," she'd say. "Well, when you get old, dot, 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 dot." Or, "Hershey bars don't taste like chocolate anymore, do they? When you get old, dot, 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 dot." Now my usually easygoing father was irritated. "We're not old, Irene, for God's sakes," he said. "At least I'm not. What do you think we are, fossils? It's not like we can't remember what mustard is for," he told my mother. "Mustard," my mother said. "Well, when you get old, dot, 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 dot." "She wants plots," Tom told us. He and Nell and I had gathered at his apartment to have a drink and decide on a gift for our parents' upcoming anniversary, which was a big one, 40 years together. We also needed to commiserate on our mother's new air of inevitability. "She wants to spend their lovely May anniversary looking at cemetery plots, and then she says that's all they want for a present from us." "What's to look at?" Nell asked. "Why would the dead care about the view?" "Get this," Tom said. "She says that when Dad is visiting her grave, she wants it to be an enjoyable spot. A little bit of heaven," she said. "Since she thinks he'll be spending a lot of time there, she's starting to drive me." "At least you two don't have kids for her to terrify," I said to them. "Thank God," said Nell. We three hadn't excelled in the area of family life. Among us, there were four divorces, Tom currently hashing out the extra one. "She is promising Lily jewelry. She's letting her pick out earrings to remember her by. It's scary for Lily," I said. "Lily asks her, why do hummingbirds hum? And instead of saying, because they don't know the words, as any idiot knows, she tells her how when you get old, you can't remember squat. It's a joke, for crying out loud." "Mom used to be the one telling the jokes," Nell said. "Remember those awful limericks?" "Lily must get it from her," I said. "So what gives?" asked Tom. "She's obsessed with death," said Nell, who was the spooky poet among us, always dressed in black. "Her friends are getting cancer, having strokes, dying. She knows the odds aren't in her favor, especially after her car wreck. She feels mortal." "So do we get them the plots?" Tom asked us. "I am not giving them space in a graveyard to celebrate their 40th wedding anniversary," I said. "It's morbid. It isn't fair to Dad. Dad doesn't want plots." "Besides," said Nell, "do you know what those cost? I think we should talk to her about cremation." "Mother of God," said Tom, as he poured himself another drink. My mother became religious. She had made sure to run the Catholic bases with her children, baptism, first communion, confirmation, home. But God had never figured prominently in our daily lives. Besides the sacraments, we had gone to church sporadically at best, and been set adrift in the sea of worldly evil in a leaky moral boat. Not one of us was a practicing Catholic, or much of a believer in anything, although Nell dabbled in reincarnation theories. But now that my mother was an old lady, she lamented our lack of devotion. "I only wish," she said to me, "that you'd been married in the church." "Ma," I said, "I'm divorced. What possible difference would that make?" It would have made a difference, she said, faking an inner wisdom. She started attending obscure church functions, First Fridays, and rosaries. She went to weekly confession. Confession was something we'd done once as children, a dark and ominous few seconds in the box. She baptized Lily in the pool when she thought I wasn't looking. That doesn't count, I told her. It counts on the battlefield, she said. It counts here. Which flowers are fun to kiss? Lily asked her. My mother looked at her. Which, my father asked, who had continued whistling and fixing a sprinkler head throughout the baptismal ceremony. Tulips, said Lily. I didn't get that one, but Daniel in my class told me, two lips, for kissing. Get it? My father laughed. Daniel got it, huh? My mother turned the look on me. What are you teaching this child? Does she understand the sanctity of marriage? The holier your mother gets, my father confided in me, the more I think that maybe 6 feet under is 6 feet under. That's all she wrote, you know? I laughed conspiratorially with him, enjoying our secret trampling of my mother's holiness. But I wish now I'd been able to say something to him with some measure of faith. Because, as only God can tell a joke, my father went first. He was golfing at the professional 18-hole course on the weekend trip that Tom and Nell and I had finally settled on for their anniversary gift, thinking it might spice up their lives to go away together, thinking second honeymoon and all the possibilities. Then he was dead, and that was all he wrote. I got one of those surrealistic phone calls. It was from Tom, who had gotten the call from the public relations guy at the golf resort who had put my mother on. I knew I shouldn't answer the phone when it rang. I don't know how, but I knew I should have let it ring itself to death. Tom was telling me an insane tale, talking about transporting a body, somebody's body, like it was checked baggage. But I had to ask, what about those electric shock things? Can't they clomp those on and start his heart again? Are you sure they tried? Is it too late to try? Why can't they just make his heart beat again? Tom was acting as if he were the dad now. He said he would call Nell, since I wasn't doing very well with the phone. But I had to tell Lily. My mother seemed paralyzed when she got back home, first with disbelief, then with grief. The talk of death had pertained only to her, she thought. Tom and Nell and I had to do all those things for him that none of us had wanted to think about. Get a plot, pick a casket, talk to the priest, go through our father's stuff. I happened on his union tie clasp, which really had been his religion. I found an ancient IOU from Tom from when he bought his first Mustang, forever uncollected. I sorted through more tools than any man, no matter how handy, could possibly use. And clothes that still smelled like him, like a sailor's aftershave and a just-opened pack of unfiltered Pall Malls. I cried. Lily cried. We'd stop and think about something else, and then we'd remember like a fist to the solar plexus, and we'd cry again. But when Lily saw him at the funeral home in his blue pinstripe suit, she said, "That's not Grandpa. That's only his skin." And I knew just what she meant, because it did look so fragile, just his body, like a shell or a snake skin, so transparent and left over that it surely would crumble into a pile of powder if he touched it. My father was nowhere in the room. Yet I knew he had to have gone somewhere. A man like that couldn't just vaporize. And if I believed that, what other vast capability for faith might I hold? My mother was angry. "How could you do this?" she asked the shell. "How could you leave me?" She was an old lady in her black lace veil, all brittle bones and shivery lines on her cheeks. But she had never intended to be an old lady alone. They'd had a pact in her mind, that she would go first, that he would be the one left to cope, to pat the dirt around the pansies on the grave while bees buzzed on a summer day. She'd had it all figured out, and he had broken that. She was furious and bereft. I wondered how she'd find it in her to do the visiting and planting she'd planned for him. "Did you ever see a fish cry?" Lily read to me on the way home from the funeral. "Huh?" I said. I was still crying, although silently now. Lily had stopped crying the moment she realized that Grandpa had merely forgotten to take his skin on his journey. "You're supposed to say, 'No, but I've seen whales blubber,'" said Lily. "Ah," I said. "I don't get it," said Lily. In my mind, I constructed the whole confusing sentence, "Blubber is whale fat, but also another word for crying your eyes out." But instead, I said, "One thing I love about you, Lily, is you get the important stuff." "How come," Lily said, "Grandpa died, but Grandma was the one who wanted to?" "The one none of us got." "I don't know," I said. "What says zub zub," read Lily. "A bee flying backwards." If only it could, I thought. Then we all could. Flying backwards, I could picture, clear as a looking glass, my dad on my 7th birthday. I could feel him sitting next to me at my little table, his trousered legs bunched up underneath, pouring milky coffee from his cup into my tea set from Ireland, my birthday treasure, and drinking with me, listening to me with grown-up respect. I would zub there right now if I could, just to let him know how hugely he mattered. "Aha," said Lily, "I get that." Four Seasons and the Moon. My daughters sprang from the cycle of the moon in this order: winter, spring, summer, fall. Like the four seasons, each child's charm is unique unto her. As my winter baby approaches her 12th birthday, her body shifts and sprouts with all the urgency of Vivaldi's strings. She is growing up. She is blossoming. It is time to talk of cycles in the moon. A lot is happening to my oldest daughter. She is walking the path of a woman, one step at a time. It is an awkward, beautiful transition between filled-up childhood and brimming adulthood. As I recall, it takes forever, and it happens overnight. My grandmother always said, "A sweater is something a baby needs to wear when her mother is cold." Batty old lady, I used to think. But the moment my daughter was born, I understood what she meant. For 9 months, my daughter was a plasmic being that was part of my body and yet not part of my body. She was not viable, but she was feisty and independent. She readily detached herself from me after 9 months of intense togetherness, just as I readily detached from her. The first thing I did after pushing her out was to eject my part of the attachment, the afterbirth. But then there existed this dependent, perfect, beautiful, horrible thing that needed me every second. Somehow I knew what to do when she faced hunger or thirst, fatigue or cold, wetness, sickness, or sadness. I could solve all of these things for her, so utterly was I tuned into her. I was given new vision through my baby's eyes. When I became a mother, many beings came to life. My daughter, myself as mother, my own mother reincarnated, and the baby I didn't remember being. I was awed to be able to look back through the drape of time and see myself as a baby, my mother as mama, cooing as I splashed my first deliberate splash or gazing the day away at me. Just as I once worshipped mama, now I had become her. The intertwining was as instinctual and complex as a spider's shimmering web. The hardest mothering of all is to give your children their own existence, to separate from them and watch them develop their own characters. Little by little, their legs lengthen and their strengths shine. As new seasons make their rounds, there are fewer physical needs you must satisfy for these stretching, searching beings. But it is hard to know when or what to stop solving, or what still is needed, both for your children and you. Their growth and maturing is a cycle as simple as spring to summer, yet so much more complicated to accept. My daughter is growing up. Slowly she progresses from wishing for breasts to being overwhelmed by breasts. She knows her physiology and understands what will happen with her menarche. We bought a package of teen-size sanitary pads, and they are tucked discreetly under the children's bathroom sink, behind the Dalmatian towels and floating mermaids. The juxtaposition of the children's toys and the tools of menstruation fills my heart. It is poignant and precise. My daughter sleeps with a well-loved stuffed elephant and wants to date. She wants to finger paint, and she wants to paint her fingers. She wants to hear a story, and she wants to know about AIDS, and she wants it all to be clear and true. She is on the cusp. My daughter is at the kitchen table. The sun has slipped down on the day. Day has pulled up the covers of night. She is half-heartedly doing her homework. My visiting grandmother sits with her, nodding to the hoot of an owl outside. My daughter is asking Gigi, short for Great Grandma, about her long-ago youth. Gigi, normally a woman of few words, is warming to the topic. My daughter has caught her in a rare, loquacious spirit. Gigi tells of playing May I in the street with the neighborhood kids and the Ice Man. She describes her father's work for the railroad in the days of dangerous union affiliations. She relates the timeless tragedy of her baby brother, who fell out of the fourth-story window and died. "How did you meet Great-Grandpa?" my daughter asks. Great-Grandpa is a man who exists for her only in photographs, as the last family occasion of his life was my wedding. "At a church dance at St. Benedict's," Gigi answers. "I was only 15. It was 1921 in the summer. My father was very strict, so we barely spoke." She leans toward my daughter and confides with ancient girlishness. "I was wearing white stockings with butterflies down the leg. He always said that's what got him, those butterfly stockings." She winks. "You know?" I am outside the window of this confidence. I look at my daughter's face, rosy and smooth, beaming at her clouded, leathery friend. I realize she does know. She is a member of the Union of All Women, even before the first showing of blood. I realize, too, most forcefully, that the cycle of the feminine, of mother, daughter, mother, does not stop with me. It turns always in the palm of God's hand. It turns in the moonlight, from Gigi to my youngest baby, from all that came before to all that will come after. I am but a phase of the moon in the season of harvest as we all dance our circles together. Dancing in the moonlight, everybody feeling warm and bright. It's such a fine and natural sight. Everybody dancing in the moonlight.
That was Valerie Schultz reading two stories, Some Kind of Bee and Four Seasons and the Moon. Both stories have been published, the first by Byline and the second by Sojourners Magazines. As we told you earlier, Valerie has been on our show many times, and after listening tonight, we can certainly understand why. Each time she brings us down to earth by telling us about true-to-life characters that come from families a lot like our very own, characters that aren't all good or all bad, but just regular people that we can relate to. In tonight's stories, Valerie writes mostly about women, from youth to adolescence to motherhood and finally to middle and old age, from daughter to mother to grandmother, how they are born, reared, come of age, and how they fulfill their role of replenishing the species and educating the next generation. "I am but a phase of the moon," her character says, in the season of harvest, as we all dance our circles. And what about the poor woman who had the misfortune of having a bee fly into her car? Even though she was only momentarily distracted, she unfortunately lost control of the vehicle she was driving. And as we heard, although it wasn't a tragic accident, no one was hurt, nor was there a great deal of damage, the biggest harm was done to the woman's own psyche, her pride and sense of self-worth. At her particular stage in life, it only took what you might otherwise call a senior moment to pretty much destroy her self-image and put her into a terribly depressed state. Let's face it, she more or less decided that the ball game was over. And then we met Lily, the granddaughter, with all her puzzles and games, and that comedian father who, no matter how hard he tried, he could just not lift his wife's morale up, couldn't get her to stop talking about how old she felt and how she had to get her funeral arrangements taken care of. And wasn't it ironic that it was the husband who crashed first on the golf course, leaving her to whine about her old age and mortality? Friends, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, we're very fortunate to have had Valerie on our show year after year from almost the very beginning. Her stories are always gripping, realistic, and seem to get better over time. She originally graduated from the University of Texas, has been published many times, and just recently authored a wonderful collection of short stories. In addition, she writes a column about parenting for the Bakersfield Californian. Thank you again, Valerie, for those two great stories tonight. We hope you'll send us more. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you would like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just get online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our writer reader will be Gary Hill. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.